people, he is offered refuge for the night. That evening, the Grail appears. Neither at this point nor at any other in the poem is it linked in any way whatever with Jesus. In fact, the reader learns very little about it. He's not even told what it is. But whatever it is, it's carried by a damsel, is golden and studded with gems. Percival does not know that he's expected to ask a question of this mysterious object. He is expected to ask whom one serves with it. The question is obviously ambiguous. If the Grail is a vessel or a dish of some kind, the question may mean who is intended to eat from it. Alternatively, the question might be rephrased, whom does one serve by virtue of serving the Grail? Whatever the meaning of the question, Percival neglects to ask it, and the next morning when he wakes, the castle is empty. His omission causes a disastrous blight on the land. Later he learns that he himself is of the Grail family, and that the mysterious Fisher King was in fact his own uncle. Cretien's version of the Grail story is less important in itself than its role as precursor. During the next half-century, the motif he had introduced was to spread through Western Europe like a brush fire. Of the numerous Grail romances which followed Cretien's version, there were three that proved of special interest and relevance to us. One of these, the Roman de l'Histoire du Saint Graal, was composed by Robert de Boron, sometime between 1190 and 1199. Robert is often credited with making the Grail a specifically Christian symbol. Robert himself states that he's drawing on an earlier source, and one quite different from Chrétien. He alludes to a great book, the secrets of which have been revealed to him. The Grail, he explains, was the cup of the Last Supper. It then passed into the hands of Joseph of Arimathea, who, when Jesus was removed from the cross, filled it with the Saviour's blood. And it is this sacred blood which confers on the Grail a magical quality. After the crucifixion, Robert continues, Joseph's family became the keepers of the Grail. And for Robert, the Grail romance involves the adventures and vicissitudes of this particular family. Thus, Galahad is said to be Joseph of Arimathea's son. And the Grail itself passes to Joseph's brother-in-law, Bronze, who carries it to England and becomes the Fisher King. As in Chrétien's poem, Percival is the son of the widow lady, but he is also grandson of the Fisher King. There is another Grail romance which has much in common with Robert's. Indeed, it would seem to draw upon the same sources, but its utilization of these sources is very different, and decidedly more interesting. The romance in question is known as the Perlet Vaux. It was composed around the same time as Robert's poem, between 1190 and 1212, by an author who chose to remain anonymous. It's odd that he should have done so, given the exalted status accorded poets. According to at least one modern expert, the Perlet Vaux may actually have been written by a Templar. It is known that the Teutonic Knights encouraged and sponsored anonymous poets in their ranks, and such a precedent could well have been established by the Templars. What is more, the author of the Perlet Vaux reveals a detailed knowledge of the realities of fighting, of armor and equipment, strategy and tactics, and weaponry and its effects on human flesh. The graphic description of wounds, for example, would seem to attest to a first-hand experience of the battlefield. If the Perlet Vaux was not actually composed by a Templar, it nevertheless provides a solid basis for linking the Templars with the Grail. Although the order is not mentioned by name, its appearance in the poem would seem to be unmistakable. Thus, Percival in his wanderings happens upon a castle. This castle does not house the Grail, but it does house a conclave of initiates, who are obviously familiar with the Grail. Percival is received here by two masters, who clap their hands and are joined by 33 other men. They were clad in white garments, and not one of them but had a red cross in the midst of his breast, and they seemed to be all of an age. One of these mysterious masters states that he has personally seen the Grail, an experience vouchsafed only to an elect few, and he also states that he is familiar with Percival's lineage. Like Chrétien's and Robert's poems, the Perlet Vaux lays an enormous stress on lineage. At numerous points, Perceval's is described as most holy. Elsewhere, it is stated explicitly that Perceval was of the lineage of Joseph of Arimathea, and that this Joseph was his, Perceval's, mother's uncle, that had been a soldier of Pilate 7 years. To a greater degree than either Chrétien's or Robert's poems, the Pearl Levaux is magical in nature. In addition to his knowledge of the battlefield, the anonymous author displays a knowledge of conjuration and invocation. There are also numerous alchemical references, to two men, for instance, made of copper by art of necromancy. And some of the magical and alchemical references resonate with echoes of the mystery surrounding the Templars. Thus, one of the masters of the white-clad Templar-like company says to Perceval, "There are the heads sealed in silver, and the heads sealed in lead, and the bodies whereunto these heads belonged. I tell you that you must make come thither the head both of the king and of the queen." If the Pearl Levaux abounds in magical illusions, it also abounds in illusions that are both heretical and or pagan. There are references to a sanctioned ritual of king sacrifice, most incongruous in a purportedly Christian poem. There are references to the roasting and devouring of children, a crime of which the Templars were popularly accused. For Chrétien, the Grail was something unspecified, made of gold and encrusted with gems. For Robert de Boron, it was the cup used at the Last Supper and subsequently to collect Jesus' blood. In the Pearl Levaux, however, the Grail assumes a most curious and significant dimension. The Grail in the Pearl Levaux consists of a changing sequence of images or visions. The first of these is a crowned king crucified. The second is a child. The third is a man wearing a crown of thorns, bleeding from his forehead, his feet, his palms, and his side. The fourth manifestation is not specified. The fifth is a chalice. On each occasion, the manifestation is attended by a fragrance and a great light. From this account, the Grail would seem to be several things simultaneously. On the mundane level, it might well be an object of some kind, a cup, bowl, or chalice. It would also, in some metaphorical sense, appear to be a lineage, or perhaps certain individuals who comprise this lineage. And quite obviously, the Grail would also seem to be an experience of some sort, quite like a Gnostic illumination such as that extolled by the Cathars and other dualist sects of the period. Of all the Grail romances, the most famous and the most artistically significant is Parsifal, composed sometime between 1195 and 1216. Its author was Wolfram von Eschenbach, a knight of Bavarian origin. At the beginning of Parsifal, Wolfram boldly asserts that Chrétien's version of the Grail story is wrong, while his own is accurate because based on privileged information. This information, he later explains, he obtained from one Kiot de Provence, who received it in turn, supposedly, from one Flegetanus. It's worth quoting Wolfram's words in full. "Anyone who asked me before about the Grail and took me to task for not telling him was very much in the wrong. Kiot asked me not to reveal this, for Adventure commanded him to give it no thought until she herself, Adventure, should invite the telling, and then one must speak of it, of course. Kiot, the well-known master found in Toledo, discarded, set down in heathen writing, the first source of this adventure. A heathen, Flegetanus, has achieved high renown for his learning. This scholar of nature was descended from Solomon and born of a family which had long been Israelite until baptism became our shield against the fire of hell. He wrote the adventure of the Grail. On his father's side, Flegetanus was a heathen who worshipped a calf. The heathen Flegetanus could tell us how all the stars set and rise again. To the circling course of the stars, man's affairs and destiny are linked. Flegetanus the heathen saw with his own eyes in the constellation things he was shy to talk about, hidden mysteries. He said there was a thing called the Grail, whose name he had read clearly in the constellations. A host of angels left it on the earth. Since then, baptized men have had the task of guarding it, and with such chaste discipline that those who are called to the service of the Grail are always noble men. Thus wrote Flegetanus of these things. Kiot, the wise master, set about to trace this tale in Latin books, to see where there ever had been a people dedicated to purity and worthy of caring for the Grail. He read the chronicles of the lands in Britain and elsewhere, in France and in Ireland, and in Anjou he found the tale. There he read the true story of Mazadin, and the exact record of all his family was written there. Of the numerous items that begged for comment in this passage, it is important to note at least four. One is that the Grail story apparently involves the family of an individual named Mazadin. And second is that the House of Anjou is in some way of paramount consequence. A third is that the original version of the story seems to have filtered into Western Europe over the Pyrenees from Muslim Spain. But the most striking element in the passage quoted is that the Grail story, as Wolfram explains its derivation, would seem ultimately to be of Judaic origin. If the Grail is so awesome a Christian mystery, why should its secret be transmitted by Judaic initiates? Scholars have wasted considerable time and energy debating whether Kio and Flegetanus are real or fictitious. In fact, the identity of Kio can be fairly solidly established. Kio de Provence would seem almost certainly to have been Guillaume de Provins, a troubadour, monk, and spokesman for the Templars who did live in Provence and who wrote love songs, attacks on the church, paeans in praise of the temple, and satirical verses. Guillaume is known to have visited Mayence in Germany in 1184. The occasion was the chivalric festival of Pentecost, at which the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, conferred knighthood on his sons. As a matter of course, the ceremony was attended by poets and troubadours from all over Christendom. As a knight of the Holy Roman Empire, Wolfram would almost certainly have been present, and it's perfectly reasonable to suppose that he and Guillaume met. And if Guillaume permits Kio to be accepted as genuine, it is at least plausible to assume that Flegetanus was genuine as well. If he was not, Wolfram and or Guillaume must have had some special purpose in creating him, and in giving him the distinctive background and pedigree he's said to have had. In addition to the Grail story, Wolfram may have obtained from Guillaume a consuming interest in the Templars. In any case, it is known that Wolfram possessed such an interest. He even made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, where he could observe the Templars in action at first hand. And in Parzival, he emphasizes that the guardians of the Grail and the Grail family are Templars. This might, of course, be the cavalier anachronism of poetic license, but Wolfram is much more careful about such things than other writers of his time. Moreover, there are the patent allusions to the temple in the Perle Vaux. Would both Wolfram and the author of the Perle Vaux be guilty of the same glaring anachronism? Possibly. But by introducing the Templars, both Wolfram and the author of the Perle Vaux may be suggesting that the Grail was not just something of the past, but also something which, for them, possessed contemporary relevance. The background to Wolfram's poem is thus as important, in some obscure way, as the text of the poem itself. Indeed, the role of the Templars, like the identity of both Kio and Flegetanus, would seem to be crucial, and these factors may well hold a key to the whole mystery surrounding the Grail. Unfortunately, the text of Parzival does little to resolve these questions, while posing a good many others. Wolfram is both precise and... Like the identity of both Kio and Flegetanus would seem to be crucial, and these factors may well hold a key to the whole mystery surrounding the Grail. Unfortunately, the text of Parzival does little to resolve these questions, while posing a good many others. Wolfram is both precise and elusive in identifying the Grail. When it first appears on Parzival's sojourn in the Fisher King's castle, there is no real indication of what it is. Among other things, it would seem to be a kind of magical cornucopia or horn of plenty. 100 squires so ordered reverently took bread in white napkins from before the Grail, stepped back in a group, and separating, passed the bread to all the tables. I was told, and I tell you too, but on your oath, not mine. Hence, if I deceive you, we are liars, all of us, that whatsoever one reached out his hand for, he found it ready. In front of the Grail, food warm or food cold, dishes new or old, meat tame or game. There never was anything like that, many will say. But they will be wrong in their angry protest, for the Grail was the fruit of blessedness. Such abundance of the sweetness of the world that its delights were very like what we are told of the kingdom of heaven. All of this is rather pedestrian, but later, when Parsifal's hermit uncle expounds on the Grail, it becomes decidedly more powerful. After a lengthy disquisition, which includes strands of flagrantly Gnostic thought, the hermit describes the Grail thus. Well, I know that many brave knights dwell with the Grail at Munsalvasha, and I will tell you how they are sustained. They live from a stone of purest kind. If you do not know it, it shall here be named to you. It is called Lapsit Exilis. By the power of that stone, the phoenix burns to ashes, but the ashes give him life again. There never was a human so ill, but that, if he one day sees that stone, he cannot die within the week that follows. And in looks, he will not fade. His appearance will stay the same, be it maid or man, as on the day he saw the stone. The same as when the best years of his life began, and though he should see the stone for 200 years, it will never change, save that his hair might perhaps turn grey. Such power does the stone give a man that flesh and bones are at once made young again. The stone is also called the Grail. According to Wolfram, then, the Grail is a stone of some kind. But such a definition of the Grail is far more provocative than satisfying. Scholars have a number of interpretations of the phrase Lapsit Exilis, all of which are more or less plausible. Lapsit Exilis might be a corruption of Lapis Ex Caelis, stone from the heavens. It might also be a corruption of Lapsit Ex Caelis, it fell from the heavens, or of Lapsis Lapsus Ex Caelis, a stone fallen from heaven, or finally, of Lapsis Exilia, the fabulous philosopher's stone of alchemy. Certainly the whole of Wolfram's poem is laden with alchemical symbolism. The phoenix, for example, is established alchemical shorthand for resurrection or rebirth, and also, in medieval iconography, is an emblem of the dying and resurrected Jesus. In the passage immediately following the one quoted, Wolfram links the Grail specifically with the crucifixion, and, through the symbol of the dove, with the Magdalene. This very day there comes to it, the Grail, a message wherein lies its greatest power. Today is Good Friday, and they await there a dove winging down from heaven. It brings a small white wafer and leaves it on the stone. Then, shining white, the dove soars up to heaven again. Always on Good Friday, it brings to the stone what I have just told you, and from that the stone derives whatever good fragrances of drink and food there are on earth, like to the perfection of paradise. Thus to the knightly brotherhood does the power of the Grail give sustenance. If the Grail's guardians are Templars, its actual custodians would appear to be members of a specific family. This family seems to possess numerous collateral branches, some of which, their identity often unknown even to themselves, are scattered about the world. But other members of the family inhabit the Grail castle of Munsalvasha. Within Munsalvasha dwell a number of enigmatic figures. There is the Grail's actual keeper and bearer, Réponse de Choix, Réponse de Choix, or Chosen Response. And there is, of course, Anfortas, the Fisher King and Lord of the Grail Castle, who is wounded in the genitals and unable to procreate, or, alternatively, to die. As in Cretien's Grail romance, Anfortas is Parsifal's uncle, And when at the end of the poem the curse is lifted, and Anfortas can at last die, Parzival becomes heir to the Grail Castle. The Grail, or the Grail family, calls certain individuals into its service from the outside world, individuals who must be initiated into some sort of mystery. At the same time, it sends its trained servitors out into the world to perform actions on its behalf, and sometimes to occupy a throne. For the Grail, apparently, possesses the power to create kings. Maidens are appointed to care for the Grail. That was God's decree, and these maidens perform their service before it. The Grail selects only noble company. Knights, devout and good, are chosen to guard it. The coming of the High Stars brings this people great sorrow, young and old alike. God's anger at them has lasted all too long. When shall they ever say yes to joy? It would seem that at some point in the past, the Grail family somehow incurred God's wrath. The allusion to God's anger at them echoes numerous medieval statements about the Jews. Could the Grail family possibly be of Judaic origin? Whatever the curse formerly visited upon the Grail family, it has unquestionably come, by Parzival's time, to enjoy divine favour, and a great deal of power as well. And yet it is rigorously enjoined, at least in certain respects to secrecy, about its identity. If the Grail family were, in fact, of Judaic origin, that, for the age in which Wolfram was writing, might constitute a possible explanation. Additional clues were provided for us by the geographical setting of Wolfram's poem. For the most part, this setting is in France. In contrast to later Grail chroniclers, Wolfram even maintains that Arthur's court, Camelot, is situated in France, specifically at Nantes. Nantes, now in Brittany, was the westernmost boundary of the old Merovingian realm at the apex of its power. In a manuscript of Gratian's version of the Grail story, Percival declares he was born in Scordone or Cynodon, and the region is described as mountainous. According to Wolfram, Parzival comes from Wales. Most scholars have taken Wales to be Wales, and Cynodon to be Snowdon or Snowdonia. If this is so, however, certain insurmountable problems arise. The characters move constantly between Wales and Arthur's court at Nantes without crossing any water. They move overland and through regions whose inhabitants speak French. Was Wolfram's geography simply sloppy, or might Wales not be Wales after all? Two scholars have suggested that it might be Valois, the region of France to the northeast of Paris. But there are no mountains in Valois, nor does the rest of the landscape conform in any way to Wolfram's description. There is another possible location for Wales, a location that is mountainous, that does conform precisely to Wolfram's other topographical descriptions, and whose inhabitants do speak French. This location is the Valais in Switzerland, on the shores of Lake Léman, to the east of Geneva. Cynodon would not be Snowdon, but Cydon-Nancis, the capital of the Valais, and the modern name of Cydon-Nancis is Sion. As the Perlevaux suggests, the Grail, at least in part, would seem to be an experience of some kind. In his excursus on the Grail's curative properties and its power to ensure longevity, Wolfram would also seem to be implying something experiential as well as symbolic, a state of mind or a state of being. There seems little question that on one level the Grail is an initiatory experience, which in modern terminology would be described as a transformation or altered state of consciousness. Alternatively, it might be described as a Gnostic experience, a mystical experience, illumination or union with God. It is possible to be even more precise and place the experiential aspect of the Grail in a very specific context. That context is the Kabbalah and Kabbalistic thought. Certainly such thought was much in the air at the time the Grail romances were composed. There was a famous Kabbalistic school at Toledo, for instance, where Kio is said to have learned of the Grail. There were other schools at Girona, Montpellier, and elsewhere in the south of France. It's impossible here to do justice to the Kabbalah or Kabbalistic thought. Nevertheless, certain points must be made in order to establish the connection between Kabbalism and the Grail romances. Very briefly, then, Kabbalism might be described as esoteric Judaism, a practical psychological methodology of uniquely Judaic origin designed to induce a dramatic transformation of consciousness. Kabbalistic training entails a series of rituals, a structured sequence of successive initiatory experiences leading the practitioner to ever more radical modifications of consciousness and cognition. Of the stages of Kabbalistic initiation, one of the most important is the stage known as Tiferet. In the Tiferet experience, the individual is said to pass beyond the world of form into the formless, or in contemporary terms, to transcend his ego. Symbolically speaking, this consists of a kind of sacrificial death, the death of the ego, of one's sense of individuality, and the isolation such individuality entails, and of course, a rebirth, or resurrection, into another dimension of all-encompassing unity and harmony. For medieval Kabbalists, the initiation into Tiferet was associated with certain specific symbols. These included a hermit or guide or wise old man, a majestic king, a child, a sacrificed god. In time, other symbols were added as well. A truncated pyramid, for example, a cube, and a rose cross. The relation of these symbols to the Grail romances is sufficiently apparent. In every Grail narrative, there is a wise old hermit who acts as a spiritual guide. And in the Pearl et Vaux, the various manifestations of the Grail correspond almost precisely to the symbols of Tiferet. We could thus identify the experiential aspect of the Grail and connect it with Kabbalism. This imparted another seemingly incongruous Judaic element to the Grail's supposedly Christian character. But whatever the Grail's experiential aspects, there were other aspects as well, aspects which we could not ignore. Was it relevant, we wondered, that the Grail romances rested so crucially on matters of lineage and genealogy, pedigree, heritage, and inheritance? Was it relevant that the lineage and genealogy in question should overlap at certain key points those which had figured so saliently in our inquiry? The House of Anjou, for instance, Guillaume de Jalon and Godefroy de Bouillon. Could the mystery attached to Rennes-le-Château and the Prairie de Sion relate in some as yet obscure way to the mysterious object called the Holy Grail? Had we, in fact, been following in Parsifal's footsteps and conducting our own modern Grail quest? The evidence suggested that this was a possibility. And indeed, there was one more crucial piece of evidence which tilted the balance decisively in favour of such a conclusion. In many of the earlier manuscripts, the Grail is called the Sangreal, and even in the later version by Malory, it's called the Sangreal. It is likely that some such form was the original one. It is also likely that the one word was subsequently broken in the wrong place. In other words, Sangreal or Sangreal may not have been intended to divide into Sangreal or Sangreal, but into Sangreal or Sangreal, or to employ the modern spelling, Sangroyal, royal blood. In itself, such wordplay might be provocative, but hardly conclusive. Taken in conjunction with the emphasis on genealogy and lineage, however, there's not much room for doubt. And for that matter, the traditional associations, the cup which caught Jesus' blood, for instance, would seem to reinforce this supposition. Quite clearly, the Grail would appear to pertain in some way to blood and a bloodline. This raises, of course, certain obvious questions. Whose blood and whose bloodline? For the writers at the time of the Crusades, the Merovingian era seems to have been of some crucial importance, so much so, in fact, that it provided the backdrop for romances which had nothing to do with either Arthur or the Grail. One such is the national epic of Germany, the Nibelungenlied, or Song of the Nibelungen, on which, in the 19th century, Wagner drew so heavily for his monumental operatic sequence, The Ring. This musical opus, and the poem from which it derives, are generally dismissed as pure fantasy. Yet the Nibelungs were a real people, a Germanic tribe who lived in late Merovingian times. Moreover, many of the names in the Nibelung Lied, Sigmund, for instance, Siegfried, Sieglinde, Brunhilde, and Kriemhild, are patently Merovingian names. Many episodes in the poem closely parallel and may even refer to specific events of Merovingian times. There was nothing revolutionary or controversial, therefore, in connecting the Grail romances with the Merovingian age. Nonetheless, we felt that something had been overlooked. Essentially, it was a question of emphasis, which, because of Arthur, had been placed primarily on Britain. As a result of this British emphasis, we had not automatically associated the Grail with the Merovingian dynasty. And yet Wolfram insists that Arthur's court is at Nantes, and that his poem is set in France. And there are medieval traditions which maintain the Grail was not brought to Britain by Joseph of Arimathea, but to France, by the Magdalene. We now began to wonder whether the preeminence assigned to Britain by commentators on the Grail romances had not perhaps been misplaced, and whether the romances, in fact, referred primarily to events on the continent, more particularly to events in France. And we began to suspect that the Grail itself, the Blood Royal, actually referred to the Blood Royal of the Merovingian dynasty, a blood which was deemed to be sacred and invested with magical or miraculous properties. If the Grail family and the Merovingian bloodline were one and the same, the Templars would indeed have been the guardians of the Grail, at the time, more or less, that the Grail romances were composed. Their presence in the Grail romances would not, therefore, have been anachronistic. The hypothesis was intriguing, but it raised one extremely crucial question. If the Grail could be identified with the Merovingian bloodline, what was its connection with Jesus? Why should something so intimately associated with Jesus also be associated with a Merovingian epoch? The Grail romances stress the importance of Jesus' blood. They also stress a lineage of some kind. And given such factors as the Grail family's culmination in Godefroy de Bouillon, they would seem to pertain to Merovingian blood. Could there possibly be some connection between these two apparently discordant elements? Could the blood of Jesus in some way be related to the blood royal of the Merovingians? Could the lineage connected with the Grail brought into Western Europe shortly after the crucifixion be intertwined with the lineage of the Merovingians? At this point, we paused to review the evidence at our disposal. It was leading us in a startling yet unmistakable direction. But why, we wondered, had this evidence never been subpoenaed by scholars before? The answer, we realized, lay in our own age and the modes or habits of thought which characterize it. Modern scholarship lays inordinate emphasis on specialization, which entails the segregation of knowledge into distinct disciplines. In consequence, the diverse spheres covered by our inquiry have traditionally been segmented into separate compartments. In each compartment, the relevant material has been duly explored and evaluated by specialists or experts in the field. But few, if any, of these experts have endeavored to establish a connection between their particular field and others that may overlap it. There have been numerous treatises on the Grail romances, their origins and development, their cultural impact, their literary quality, and there have been numerous studies, valid and otherwise, of the Templars and the Crusades. But few experts on the Grail romances have been historians, while fewer still have displayed much interest in the complex, often sordid and not very romantic history behind the Templars and the Crusades. Similarly, historians of the Templars and the Crusades have, like all historians, adhered closely to factual records and documents. The Grail romances have been dismissed as mere fiction, as nothing more than a cultural phenomenon, a species of byproduct generated by the imagination of the age. To suggest to such a historian that the Grail romances might contain a kernel of historical truth would be tantamount to heresy. True, various occult writers, proceeding primarily on the basis of wishful thinking, have given literal credence to the legends, claiming that in some mystical way The Templars were custodians of the Grail, whatever the Grail might be. But there has been no serious historical study that endeavours to establish any real connection. The Templars are regarded as fact, the Grail as fiction, and no association between the two is possible. If historians are unprepared to make such connections, biblical scholars are even less prepared to do so. During the last few decades, a welter of books has appeared, according to which Jesus was a pacifist, an Essene, a mystic, a Buddhist, a sorcerer, a revolutionary, a homosexual, even a mushroom. But despite this plethora of material on Jesus and the historical context of the New Testament, not one author, to our knowledge, has touched on the question of the Grail. Why should he? But reality, history, and knowledge cannot be segmented and compartmentalized according to the arbitrary filing system of the human intellect. And while documentary evidence may be hard to come by, traditions may survive for 1,000 years and then surface in a written form that does illuminate previous events. Without Homer's work, composed long after the fact, no one would have even heard of the Siege of Troy. Any responsible researcher must, like a detective, pursue whatever clues come to hand, however seemingly improbable. One should not dismiss material out of hand because it threatens to lead into unlikely or unfamiliar territory. What is necessary is an interdisciplinary approach to one's material, a mobile and flexible approach that permits one to move freely between disparate disciplines, across space and time. One must be able to link data and make connections between people, events, and phenomena widely divorced from each other. One must be able to move, as necessity dictates, from the 3rd to the 12th to the 7th to the 18th centuries, drawing on a varied spectrum of sources. It's not sufficient to confine oneself exclusively to facts. One must also discern the repercussions and ramifications of facts, as those repercussions and ramifications radiate through the centuries, often in the form of myth and legend. True, the facts themselves may be distorted in the process, like an echo reverberating among cliffs. But if the voice itself cannot be located, the echo, however distorted, may yet point the way to it. Facts are like pebbles dropped into the pool of history. They disappear quickly, but they generate ripples which, if one's perspective is broad enough, enable one to pinpoint where the pebble originally fell. It was now becoming apparent to us that everything we had studied during our investigation was but a ripple, which, monitored correctly, might direct us to a single stone cast into the pool of history 2,000 years ago. The Magdalene had figured prominently throughout our inquiry. According to certain medieval legends, the Magdalene brought the Holy Grail, or Blood Royal, into France. The Grail is closely associated with Jesus, and the Grail, on one level at least, relates in some way to blood, or more specifically, to a bloodline and lineage. The Grail romances are for the most part, however, set in Merovingian times, but they were not composed until after Godefroy de Bouillon, fictional scion of the Grail family and actual scion of the Merovingians, was installed in everything but name as King of Jerusalem. If we had been dealing with anyone other than Jesus, these fragmentary shreds of evidence alone would have led to one glaring self-evident conclusion. We drew that conclusion, however controversial and explosive it might be. We began to test it, at least as a tentative hypothesis. Perhaps the Magdalene was, in fact, Jesus's wife. Perhaps their union produced offspring. After the crucifixion, perhaps the Magdalene, with at least one child, was smuggled to Gaul, where established Jewish communities already existed, and where, in consequence, she might have found a refuge. Perhaps there was an hereditary bloodline descended directly from Jesus. Perhaps this bloodline, this supreme sang real, then perpetuated itself for some 400 years, which is not, after all, a very long time for an important lineage. Perhaps there were dynastic intermarriages, not only with other Jewish families, but with Romans and Visigoths as well. And perhaps in the 5th century, Jesus' lineage became allied with the royal line of the Franks, thereby engendering the Merovingian dynasty. If this sketchy hypothesis was in any sense true, it would explain a great many elements in our investigation. It would explain the extraordinary status accorded to the Magdalene and the cult significance she attained during the Crusades. It would explain the sacred status accorded the Merovingians. It would explain the stress laid on the assassination of Dagobert II, for the Church, by being party to that murder, would have been guilty not only of regicide, but according to its own tenets, of a form of deicide as well. It would explain the attempt to eradicate Dagobert from history. It would explain the Carolingians' obsession to legitimize themselves as Holy Roman Emperors by claiming a Merovingian pedigree. A bloodline descended from Jesus through Dagobert would also explain the Grail family in the romances, the secrecy which surrounds it, its exalted status. Finally, it would explain the mystical pedigree of Godefroy de Bouillon, son or grandson of Lohengrin, grandson or great-grandson of Parsifal, scion of the Grail family. And if Godefroy were descended from Jesus, his triumphant capture of Jerusalem in 1099 would have entailed far more than simply rescuing the Holy Sepulchre from the infidel. Godefroy would have been reclaiming his own rightful heritage. Our hypothetical scenario was both logically consistent and intriguing. As yet, however, it was also preposterous. Before we could seriously entertain it, we would have to determine whether there was any real evidence to sustain it. In an attempt to find such evidence, we began to explore the Gospels, the historical context of the New Testament, and the writings of the early Church Fathers. As everyone knows, there are numerous forms of Christianity, Roman Catholicism, for example, or the Church of England. There are the various other denominations of Protestantism, from the original Lutheranism and Calvinism of the 16th century to such relatively recent developments as Unitarianism. There are evangelical congregations such as the Seventh-day Adventists, and there are assorted contemporary sects and cults. If one surveys this bewildering spectrum of beliefs, from the rigidly dogmatic and conservative to the radical and ecstatic, it is difficult to determine what exactly constitutes Christianity. If there is a single factor that does link the otherwise diverse and divergent Christian creeds, it is the New Testament, and more specifically, in the accounts of Jesus known as the Four Gospels. From childhood, one is led to believe that the story of Jesus, as it is preserved in the Four Gospels, is, if not God-inspired, at least definitive. The four evangelists, supposed authors of the Gospels, are deemed to be unimpeachable witnesses who reinforce and confirm each other's testimony. Relatively few people are aware that the four Gospels not only contradict each other, but at times violently disagree. So far as popular tradition is concerned, the origin and birth of Jesus are well enough known. But in reality, only two of the Gospels, Matthew and Luke, say anything at all about Jesus' origins and birth, and they are flagrantly at odds with each other. According to Matthew, Jesus was an aristocrat, if not a rightful and legitimate king, descended from David via Solomon. According to Luke, Jesus' family, though descended from the house of David, was of somewhat less exalted stock, and it is on the basis of this account that the legend of the poor carpenter came into being. The two genealogies are so strikingly discordant that they might well be referring to two quite different individuals. The discrepancies are not confined to the question of Jesus' ancestry and genealogy. According to Luke, Jesus, on his birth, was visited by shepherds. According to Matthew, he was visited by wise men. According to Luke, Jesus' family lived in Nazareth. From here they are said to have journeyed to Bethlehem, where Jesus was born in the poverty of a manger. But according to Matthew, Jesus' family had been fairly well-to-do residents of Bethlehem all along, and Jesus was born in a house. In Matthew's version, Herod's persecution of the innocents prompts the family to flee into Egypt, and only on their return do they make their home in Nazareth. There is no possible means whereby the two conflicting narratives can both be correct, and there is no means whereby they can be reconciled. Whether one cares to admit it or not, the Gospels cannot be regarded as unimpugnable. How can they, when they impugn each other. The more one studies the Gospels, the more the contradictions between them become apparent. Indeed, they do not even agree on the day of the crucifixion. According to John's Gospel, the crucifixion occurred on the day before the Passover. According to the Gospels of Mark, Luke, and Matthew, it occurred on the day after. Nor are the Gospels in accord on the personality and character of Jesus. Each depicts a figure patently at odds with the figure depicted in the others. A meek, lamb-like saviour in Luke, a powerful and majestic sovereign in Matthew. And there is further disagreement about Jesus' last words on the cross. In Matthew and Mark, these words are, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? In Luke, they are, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And in John, they are simply, it is finished. Given these discrepancies, the Gospels can only be accepted as a highly questionable authority, and certainly not as definitive. They do not represent the perfect word of any God, or if they do, God's words have been very liberally censored, edited, revised, glossed, and rewritten by human hands. The Bible, it must be remembered, and this applies to both the Old and New Testaments, is only a selection of works, and in many respects a somewhat arbitrary one. In AD 367, Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria compiled a list of works to be included in the New Testament. This list was ratified by the Church Council of Hippo in 393, and again by the Council of Carthage 4 years later. At these councils, a selection was agreed upon. Certain works were assembled to form the New Testament, as we know it today, and others were ignored. How can such a process of selection possibly be regarded as definitive, especially when some of the excluded books have a perfectly valid claim to historical veracity? As it exists today, moreover, the Bible has also been subjected to some fairly drastic editing, censorship, and revision. In 1958, for example, Professor Morton Smith of Columbia University discovered in a monastery near Jerusalem a letter which contained a missing fragment of the Gospel of Mark. The missing fragment had not been lost. On the contrary, it had apparently been deliberately suppressed at the instigation, if not the express behest, of Bishop Clement of Alexandria, one of the most venerated of the early church fathers. Clement, it seems, had received a letter from one Theodore, who complained of a Gnostic sect, the Carpocratians. The Carpocratians appear to have been interpreting certain passages of the Gospel of Mark in accordance with their own principles, principles that did not concur with the position of Clement and Theodore. In consequence, Theodore apparently attacked them and reported his action to Clement. In the letter found by Professor Smith, Clement replies to his disciple as follows. You did well in silencing the unspeakable teachings of the Carpocratians. Such men are to be opposed in all ways and altogether. For even if they should say something true, one who loves the truth should not even so agree with them. For not all true things are the truth, nor should that truth which merely seems true according to human opinions be preferred to the true truth, that according to the faith. In the following passage, Clement's letter goes on to discuss Mark's gospel and its misuse, in his eyes, by the Carpocratians. As for Mark, then, during Peter's stay in Rome, he wrote an account of the Lord's doings, not, however, declaring all of them, nor yet hinting at the secret ones, but selecting those he thought most useful for increasing the faith of those who were being instructed. But when Peter died as a martyr, Mark came over to Alexandria, bringing both his own notes and those of Peter, from which he transferred to his former book the things suitable to whatever makes for progress towards knowledge, gnosis. Thus he composed a more spiritual gospel for the use of those who were being perfected. Dying, he left his composition to the church in Alexandria, where it even yet is most carefully guarded, being read only to those who are being initiated into the great mysteries. Clement thus acknowledges that there is an authentic secret gospel of Mark. He then instructs Theodore to deny it. To them, the Carpocratians, therefore, as I said above, one must never give way, nor, when they put forward their falsifications, should one concede that the secret gospel is by Mark, but should even deny it on oath. For not all true things are to be said to all men. What was this secret gospel that Clement ordered his disciple to repudiate, and that the Carpocratians were misinterpreting? Clement answers the question by including a word-for-word transcription of the text in his letter. "And they came into Bethany, and a certain woman whose brother had died was there. And coming, she prostrated herself before Jesus, and says to him, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' But the disciples rebuked her, and Jesus, being angered, went off with her into the garden where the tomb was. And straightway a great cry was heard from the tomb. And going near, Jesus rolled away the stone from the door of the tomb, and straightway going in where the youth was, he stretched forth his hand and raised him, seizing his hand. But the youth, looking upon him, loved him and began to beseech him that he might be with him. And going out of the tomb, they came into the house of the youth, for he was rich. And after 6 days, Jesus told him what to do. And in the evening, the youth comes to him, wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. And thence arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan." This episode appears in no existing version of the Gospel of Mark. In its general outlines, however, it is familiar. It is, of course, the raising of Lazarus, described in the fourth Gospel, ascribed to John. In the version quoted, there are some significant variations. In the first place, there is a great cry from the tomb before Jesus rolls the rock aside, or instructs the occupant to come forth. This suggests that the occupant was not dead, and thereby, at a single stroke, contravenes any element of the miraculous. In the second place, the passage quoted attests to some special relation between the man in the tomb and the man who resurrects him. A modern reader might be tempted to see a hint of homosexuality. It is possible that the Carpocratians, a sect who aspired to transcendence of the sense by means of satiation of the senses, discerned precisely such a hint. But as Professor Smith argues, it is in fact much more likely that the whole episode refers to a typical mystery school initiation, a ritualized and symbolic death and rebirth of the sort so prevalent in the Middle East at the time. In any case, the point is that the episode and the passage quoted do not appear in any modern or accepted version of Mark. If Mark's gospel was so drastically expurgated, it was also burdened with spurious additions. In its original version, it ends with the crucifixion, the burial, and the empty tomb. There is no resurrection scene, no reunion with the disciples. The Gospel of Mark thus provides two instances of a sacred document, supposedly inspired by God, which has been tampered with, censored, revised by human hands. It is reasonable to assume that the other Gospels were similarly treated. For the purposes of our investigation, we could not accept the Gospels as unimpugnable, but at the same time, we could not discard them. They were certainly not wholly fabricated, and they furnished some of the few clues available to what really happened in the Holy Land 2,000 years ago. We therefore undertook to look more closely, to separate the truth they contained from the spurious matrix in which that truth was often embedded. And in order to do this effectively, we were first obliged to familiarize ourselves with the historical reality and circumstances of the Holy Land at the advent of the Christian era. For the Gospels are historical documents like any other. They are products of a very specific place, a very specific time, a very specific people, and very specific historical factors. More than half a century before Jesus' birth, Palestine fell to the armies of Pompey, and Roman rule was imposed. But Rome at the time was too preoccupied with her own affairs to install the administrative apparatus necessary for direct rule. She therefore created a line of puppet kings to rule under her aegis. This line was that of the Herodians, who were not Jewish, but Arab. One must visualize a conquered land and a conquered people ruled by a puppet regime which was kept in power by military force. The people of the country were allowed to retain their own religion and customs, but the final authority was Rome. In AD 6, the country was split administratively into one province, Judea and Samaria, and two tetrarchies, Perea and Galilee. Herod Antipas became ruler of the latter, but Judea, the capital, was rendered subject to direct Roman rule, administered by a Roman prefect based at Caesarea. The Roman regime was brutal and autocratic. 3,000 rebels were summarily crucified. The temple was plundered and defiled. Heavy taxation was imposed, torture was frequently employed, and many of the populace committed suicide. This state of affairs was not improved by Pontius Pilate, who presided as prefect of Judea from AD 26 to 36. In contrast to the biblical portraits of him, existing records indicate that Pilate was a cruel and corrupt man who not only perpetuated but intensified the abuses of his predecessor. The Jews in the Holy Land at the time could be loosely divided into several sects and subsects. There were, for example, the Sadducees, a small but wealthy landowning class who collaborated with the Romans. There were the Pharisees, a progressive group who introduced much reform into Judaism and who, despite the portrait of them in the Gospels, placed themselves in staunch, albeit largely passive, opposition to Rome. There were the Essenes, an austere, mystically oriented sect whose teachings were much more prevalent and influential than is generally acknowledged or supposed. Among the smaller sects and subsects, there were many whose precise character has long been lost to history, and which therefore are difficult to define. It is worth citing the Nazareans or Nazarenes, a term which seems to have been applied to Jesus and his followers. Indeed, the original Greek version of the New Testament refers to Jesus as Jesus of Nazarene, which is mistranslated in English as Jesus of Nazareth. Nazarene is a specifically sectarian word and has no connection with Nazareth. There were numerous other groups and sects as well, one of which proved a particular relevance to our inquiry. In AD 6, when Rome assumed direct control of Judea, a Pharisee rabbi known as Judas of Galilee had created a highly militant revolutionary group known as Zealots. By the time of Jesus' mission, the Zealots had assumed an increasingly prominent role in the Holy Land's affairs. Long after the crucifixion, Zealot activity continued. By AD 44, this activity had so intensified that some sort of armed struggle seemed inevitable. In AD 66, the struggle erupted, the whole of Judea rising in organized revolt against Rome. It was a desperate, tenacious, but ultimately futile conflict. At Caesarea alone, 20,000 Jews were massacred by the Romans. Within 4 years, Roman legions had occupied Jerusalem, razed the city, and sacked and plundered the temple. The aftermath of the revolt in Judea witnessed a massive exodus of Jews from the Holy Land. Nevertheless, enough remained to foment another rebellion some 60 years later, in AD 132. At last, in 135, the Emperor Hadrian decreed that all Jews be expelled by law from Judea, and Jerusalem became essentially a Roman city. Jesus' lifetime spanned roughly the first 35 years of a turmoil extending over 140 years. The turmoil did not cease with his death, but continued for another century, and it engendered the psychological and cultural adjuncts inevitably attending any such sustained defiance of an oppressor. One of these adjuncts was the hope and longing for a Messiah who would deliver his people from the tyrant's yoke. It was only by virtue of historical and semantic accident that this term came to be applied exclusively to Jesus. For Jesus' contemporaries, no Messiah would have ever been regarded as divine. Indeed, the very idea of a divine Messiah would have been preposterous. The Greek word for Messiah is Christ or Christos. The term, whether in Hebrew or Greek, meant simply the anointed one, and generally referred to a king. Thus David, when he was anointed king in the Old Testament, became a Messiah or a Christ, and every subsequent Jewish king of the house of David was known by the same appellation. Even during the Roman occupation of Judea, the Roman-appointed high priest was known as the Priest Messiah or Priest Christ. For the Zealots, however, and for other opponents of Rome, this puppet priest was a false Messiah. For them, the true Messiah implied something very different. the legitimate Roi Perdu, or Lost King, the unknown descendant of the House of David who would deliver his people from Roman tyranny. During Jesus' lifetime, anticipation of the coming of such a Messiah attained a pitch verging on mass hysteria, and this anticipation continued after Jesus' death. Indeed, the revolt of AD 66 was prompted in large part by zealot agitation and propaganda on behalf of a Messiah whose advent was said to be imminent. The term Messiah implied nothing divine. It was a term with specifically political connotations. It was this mundane political term that was applied to Jesus. He was called Jesus the Messiah, or translated into Greek, Jesus the Christ. Only later was this designation contracted to Jesus Christ, and a purely fictional title distorted into a proper name. The Gospels issued from a recognizable and concrete historical reality. It was a reality of oppression, of civic and social discontent, of political unrest, of incessant persecution and intermittent rebellion. There was also a reality suffused with perpetual and tantalizing promises, hopes and dreams that a rightful king would appear, a spiritual and secular leader who would deliver his people into freedom. Modern scholars are unanimous in concurring that the Gospels do not date from Jesus' lifetime. For the most part, they date from the period between the two major revolts in Judea, 66 to 74 and 132 to 135, although they are almost certainly based on earlier accounts. These earlier accounts may have included written documents since lost, but there would certainly have been oral traditions as well. Some of these were undoubtedly received at second, third, or fourth hand. Others may have derived from individuals who were alive in Jesus' lifetime and may even have known him personally. A young man at the time of the crucifixion might well have been alive when the Gospels were composed. The earliest of the Gospels is generally considered to be Mark's, composed sometime during the revolt of 66 to 74, or shortly thereafter. Although not himself one of Jesus' original disciples, Mark seems to have come from Jerusalem. He seems to have been a companion of St. Paul, and his Gospel bears an unmistakable stamp of Pauline thought. But if Mark was a native of Jerusalem, his Gospel was composed in Rome, and addressed to a Greco-Roman audience. At the time that Mark's Gospel was composed, Judea was, or had recently been, in open revolt, and thousands of Jews were being crucified for rebellion against the Roman regime. If Mark wished his Gospel to survive and impress itself on a Roman audience, he could not possibly present Jesus as anti-Roman. Indeed, he could not feasibly present Jesus as politically oriented at all. He would have been obliged to exonerate the Romans of all guilt for Jesus' death and blame the death on certain Jews. This device was adopted not only by the authors of other Gospels, but by the early Christian church as well. Without such a device, neither Gospels nor church would have survived. The Gospel of Luke is dated by scholars at around AD 80. Luke himself appears to have been a Greek doctor who composed his work for a high-ranking Roman official at Caesarea, the Roman capital of Palestine. For Luke too, therefore, it would have been necessary to placate and appease the Romans and transfer the blame elsewhere. By the time the Gospel of Matthew was composed, approximately AD 85, such a transference seems to have been accepted as an established fact and gone unquestioned. More than half of Matthew's Gospel, in fact, is derived directly from Mark's. The author seems to have been a Jew, quite possibly a refugee from Palestine. He is not to be confused with the disciple named Matthew, who would have lived much earlier and would probably have known only Aramaic. The Gospels of Mark, Luke, and Matthew are known collectively as the Synoptic Gospels, implying that they see eye to eye or with one eye, which, of course, they do not. Nevertheless, there is enough overlap between them to suggest that they derived from a single common source. This distinguishes them from the Gospel of John, which portrays significantly different origins. Nothing whatever is known about the author of the fourth Gospel. Indeed, there is no reason to assume his name was John. Except for John the Baptist, the name John is mentioned at no point in the Gospel itself, and its attribution to a man called John is generally accepted as later tradition. The fourth Gospel is the latest of those in the New Testament, composed around AD 100 in the vicinity of the Greek city of Ephesus. It displays a number of quite distinctive features. There is no nativity scene, for example, no description whatever of Jesus' birth, and the opening is almost Gnostic in character. The text is of a decidedly more mystical nature than the other Gospels, and the content differs as well. The other Gospels, for instance, concentrate primarily on Jesus' activities in the northern province of Galilee, and reflect what appears to be only a second or third-hand knowledge of events to the south, including the crucifixion. The fourth Gospel, in contrast, says relatively little about Galilee. It dwells exhaustively on the events in Judea and Jerusalem, which concluded Jesus' career, and its account of the crucifixion may well rest on some first-hand eyewitness testimony. It also contains a number of episodes and incidents which don't figure in the other Gospels at all. On the basis of such factors, modern scholars have suggested that the Gospel of John, despite its late composition, may well be the most reliable and historically accurate of the four. More than the other Gospels, it seems to draw upon traditions current among contemporaries of Jesus, as well as other material unavailable to Mark, Luke, and Matthew. One modern researcher points out that it reflects an apparently first-hand topographical knowledge of Jerusalem prior to the revolt of AD 66. The same author concludes, "Behind the fourth Gospel lies an ancient tradition independent of the other Gospels." This is not an isolated opinion. In fact, it is the most prevalent in modern biblical scholarship. On the basis of our own research, we too concluded that the fourth Gospel was the most reliable of the books in the New Testament, even though it, like the others, had been subjected to doctoring, editing, expurgation, and revision. It was in the fourth Gospel that we found the most persuasive evidence of our, as yet, tentative hypothesis. It was not our intention to discredit the Gospels. We sought only to locate certain fragments of possible or probable truth. Fragments that might attest to a marriage between Jesus and the woman known as the Magdalene. Such attestations, needless to say, would not be explicit. In order to find them, we realized we would be obliged to read between the lines. We would also have to look for evidence of circumstances that might have been conducive to a marriage. Our inquiry would thus have to encompass a number of distinct but closely related questions. We began with the most obvious of them. Is there any evidence in the Gospels, direct or indirect, to suggest that Jesus was indeed married? There is, of course, no explicit statement to the effect that he was. On the other hand, there is no explicit statement to the effect that he was not, and this is both more curious and more significant than it might first appear. The Gospels state that many of the disciples were married, and at no point does Jesus himself advocate celibacy. On the contrary, in Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 through 5, he declares, "Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh." Such a statement can hardly be reconciled with an injunction to celibacy. And if Jesus did not preach celibacy, there's no reason either to suppose that he practiced it. According to Judaic custom at the time, it was not only usual but almost mandatory that a man be married. Except among certain Essenes in certain communities, celibacy was vigorously condemned. During the late 1st century, one Jewish writer even compared deliberate celibacy with murder, and he does not seem to have been alone in this attitude. And it was as obligatory for a Jewish father to find a wife for his son as it was to ensure that his son be circumcised. If Jesus were not married, this fact would have been glaringly conspicuous. It would have drawn attention to itself and been used to characterize and identify him. It would have set him apart in some significant sense from his contemporaries. If this were the case, surely one at least of the Gospel accounts would make some mention of so marked a deviation from custom. If Jesus were indeed as celibate as later tradition claims, it is extraordinary that there is no reference to any such celibacy. The absence of such reference strongly suggests that Jesus was married. This alone would satisfactorily explain the silence of the Gospels on the matter. The argument is summarized by a respected contemporary theological scholar. It is highly probable that Jesus was not married well before the beginning of his public ministry. If he had insisted upon celibacy, it would have created a stir, a reaction which would have left some trace. So the lack of mention of Jesus' marriage in the Gospels is a strong argument not against but for the hypothesis of marriage, because any practice or advocacy of voluntary celibacy would, in the Jewish context of the time, have been so unusual as to have attracted much attention and comment. The hypothesis of marriage becomes all the more tenable by virtue of the title Rabbi, which is frequently applied to Jesus in the Gospels. It is possible, of course, that this term is employed in its very broadest sense, meaning simply a self-appointed teacher. But Jesus' literacy strongly suggests that he underwent some species of formal rabbinical training. This would conform to tradition, which depicts Jesus as a rabbi in the strict sense of the word. But if Jesus was a rabbi in the strict sense of the word, a marriage would not only have been likely, but virtually certain. The Jewish Mishnaic law is quite explicit on the subject. An unmarried man may not be a teacher.